This podcast was recorded at Hartford Street Zen Center, Isanji, in San Francisco. Please help support our temple by making a donation at hszc.org.
One of our ancestors said that if you want to know the Undying One in the Hermitage, don't separate from this skin bag right now. And it's a kind of capsule instruction for our practice. And I don't know how people feel when they hear that. I guess if you're not accustomed to that kind of language, maybe you're puzzled or annoyed or something. But when I hear stuff like that, I sometimes I feel a little joy myself. And joy, of course, is one of the important human capacities. In Buddhism, they don't talk about that so much. It usually comes up in the context of meditative cultivation, and it's one of the qualities of some of the primary meditative states. There's a system, one of many, where there are kind of like eight states of meditative absorption. And the first four have joy as one of the qualities. But apart from that, you don't hear about it so much in Buddhism. And I think this is because a lot of our emotional experience comes with a quite a bit of attachment. Similarly, in Buddhism, you don't hear much about love. Except as a source of trouble, which, goodness knows, it can be. But pretty much all of these emotional currents, whether positive or negative, they have a certain kind of tar baby quality to them. Namely, if you touch them, you're liable to get stuck. So, in our cultivation, we're trying to develop a bodily understanding of what it means not to touch any of these states that arise and pass away. And as we develop that bodily sense, then tendency, a very strong karmic tendency to identify these transitory states with the self actually begins to decrease. They sometimes say it's like it's the way water dripping on stone will eventually go right through the rock. And our cultivation is quite similar in that to use that metaphor of the dripping water, if you just look at one drop and how it lands on the rock, you know, it's not very impressive. But if you actually watch the process, you eventually see that this each drop actually has some impact. And that the nature of water and the nature of rock completely support this process. So in other words, neither water nor rock has to know anything particular or special in addition to just being water and rock in order for this process to continue such that eventually the rock has a hole in it. So, as I say, we don't necessarily talk that much about joy, except as this quality of certain meditative states. And yet, it's not really something that we can entirely do without. Among others, the great Jungian psychologist Robert Johnson has pointed out that in our modern life, this quality of joy that arises from this very body-mind as the source has kind of been kind of lost that. And as a result, people are finding various, or trying to anyway, substitutes. So as a result, we have various addictions and an extremely powerful entertainment industry and various other features of modern life which seem to promise that this joyful quality can be engineered. But pretty much that's not how it actually works out. And when we've tried the engineering approach for a while, very often we're actually even more discouraged. So these the engineered approach can give rise to more transitory states that are more or less pleasurable, some of them. But quality of joy as a thread that runs throughout our life isn't like that. And in searching for a substitute, we often find ourselves very discouraged. So Suzuki Roshi, of course, mentions joy in Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, and he says the joy that we find in our practice is not this engineered type. In fact, it's the joy that comes up spontaneously and quite naturally. That is, it's not as a result of arranging certain factors in some way that you can think up. Instead, joy, the significant kind, is a quality of being. So, very often, we the chronic deprivation of this joy results in people being kind of, depressed. And eventually, with enough sort of negative feedback, this quality of depression becomes like a rock. And people actually come to believe that it's a sort of monolith, a huge stone. And then in therapeutic contexts, it could take quite a lot of work to kind of pry people away from that belief so that they are ready to be surprised by joy. Is that C.S. Lewis? Somebody? Because once you convince yourself that that's impossible, then, you're in for a tough slog, as they say. Robert Johnson points out that the current of joy and its importance is quite well recognized in our mythic inheritance. And even the danger of substituting something engineered for that joy is also recognized in various myths. And so one aspect of our practice, or one way of looking at it, is kind of reconditioning body-mind so that we also are prepared to be surprised by this joyful current, which, it could be, you might say, I don't think I would say it's triggered by, but our notice of it may be triggered by something like sunlight or breeze or dog barking. You have no way of telling what. But if our sensitivity to that current has been kind of blunted by all these attempts to engineer a desirable state, it can be a while before we're actually able to respond to that subtle yet just about constant current. So a lot of Suzuki Roshi's instructions about practice are geared towards helping us to relax and be patient with that process of water dripping on stone. Now, some other approaches to practice, of course, are they hint around, if not indeed make explicit reference to at some point in the future being struck by a bolt of joyful lightning. And if you practice in a certain way, you kind of make yourself a lightning rod. And someday you will get struck. And that's okay as a skillful means. We say anupaya Sanskrit, a way of getting people to practice and kind of encouraging them to continue by telling them, you're doing good, you're looking like pretty much like a lightning rod, so keep at it. And then at some point, they may get struck by lightning, or anyway, they may have some moment where they actually notice this current of joy in them, and it's not tied to anything in particular. Of course, a lot of our stories in the Chan and Zen tradition are about this, or anyway, sometimes people say, well, they're about this lightning strike. But as you may have noticed, almost all of them are very, in fact, just about all of them, are very lacking in detail. So they say, so-and-so had a great awakening. But they don't say what that was. They stop there and say, so-and-so had a great awakening. Say, oh, cool. Well, that must be like that lightning thing. You go, whoa, man. This is really, I'm now truly energized. And well, one of the problems with that, as with all upayas, is that if you attach to the means itself, you can actually get in your own way. So one of the challenges is to make us aware that we actually had some idea of what that lightning strike will feel like, and that we actually wind up waiting for that idea to arrive. And as a result, we're missing what's actually happening. And yet, all of these stories that say, so-and-so had a great awakening, that phrase points into the unknown. It points into the, if you like, the realm where joy arises naturally, spontaneously, uncontrived. So, to kind of honor the integrity of water dripping on stone, we have this practice here of just sitting still, like a rock or like water dripping. You know, if you watch water dripping from the eaves of a building, you can almost set your watch by it. This is its nature. And, you know, it hits the stone and this little splash. And as I said, it doesn't look like much, but eventually there will be a deep hole there, all the way through. So instead of painting for ourselves a picture of what the stone will be like when the water has gone all the way through, our practice is the practice of every drop, moment after moment, just the way water falls from the roof. Sitting in that patient stillness, all the natural currents of our life and our being flowing as they do, in and out with the breath, using the yoga of this body to find a place of balance. And again, reconditioning this body-mind, to be once again sensitive to this current of joy that can come up unexpectedly. One of the therapies for people who are depressed utilizes a kind of a hypnotic protocol where the therapist kind of very, very, very gently presents a suggestion that the person who has convinced him or herself the monolithic nature of this depressed state actually does not know, could not predict when the light will come through. When the glimpse of a puddle of water or one's cat or something will be light. And that the conviction of the monolithic quality of this depression has actually prevented the person from seeing these moments, brief and beautiful as they are. And eventually, the person who has convinced himself or herself of this bottomless depression will be surprised by something joyful. And just like, what is it, the black swan proves that not all swans are white. Now that single moment shatters the illusion of this unbreakable depression. So our practice is somewhat like that. Setting aside our various convictions about who we are and life and time and et cetera, and allowing ourselves to be surprised by the way things actually are. This is why our ancestor Dogen says things like, "The gate of liberation is open." Not, you must take it by storm and blow it up, which is another approach, but it's already open. So this way, the all-important quality of joy in our life can, you can allow it to come back like a timid, a shy forest animal. Instead of trying to substitute it by various coarser experiences. So, just like the water falling on the rock, you can't really rush it. In the West, we might think, "Well, what the heck? Just use some dynamite and blow the rock right out of the scenery there." Like, yeah, well, that doesn't actually work. There's a the Australian instrument, the didgeridoo. I have wound up with one through no merit of my own. That is the real variety. Now, the real variety of the didgeridoo is not hollowed out by humans. It's hollowed out by termites. And that's actually the difference. The real instrument, the real call it the dreamtime sound, comes from these tree limbs that have been hollowed out by the steady munching of the termites, rather than somebody taking a drill or something manufacturing these gadgets, these devices for the tourist trade. People have found out that you can even take plastic plumbing pipe and make a didgeridoo out of it. Somehow it's not the same. So we don't want to accept any substitute for true joy. And it does mean kind of resigning ourselves to understanding that we can't really provoke that or make that happen. All we can do is honor that quality of this body-mind by how we live, and thus make it possible for us to be surprised by this current of joy. And as quickly as it arises, it passes away, so don't try to hang on to it. Eventually, of course, somehow the actual nature of things reveals this joyful quality, the way reality in fact is. So then we don't, we stop worrying about when's my next jolt of joy coming. We don't have to worry about that. And really, I'm just I'm talking about Buddha's teaching, even though he may not have used the word joy so much. I'm pretty convinced, among other things, that's what he was talking about. And that the real joy comes from seeing how things really are. Namely, that the gate of liberation is open. So I pretty much never, like I've said, I never listen to my talks after I give them because I'm afraid of what I might hear. I believe I said that. But anyway, so as usual, I'm not quite clear what I just told you guys, but if you'd like to try to clarify by asking a question or making a comment, please feel free.
Yeah. Thank you for the talk. Very helpful. And my question is, do you know how to play your didgeridoo?
Badly. No. Pretty much ever since I've had it, I've lived somewhere where there are other people around. It's like, oh no, I don't want to, I have to wait till like everyone's gone and then I can go into my closet and play the thing. But the one I have is actually rather difficult to play because it's very large and the chamber hollowed out by the termites is such that there isn't a lot of what they call back pressure, which makes it a little harder to play. So no, I don't play it very well.
I have a suggestion. A Civic Center Muni station. It's where most people practice.
I see. Okay. Yeah, I should have some lessons. There's a thing you can do with a drinking straw and a glass of water to teach you the so-called circular breathing, which I practiced some. But for fear of annoying my neighbors, I haven't done it much.
I'm wondering about the relation between joy and calm tranquility. If there's a difference, what?
Yeah. Well, in that discussion of meditative states, the as you, so to speak, ascend through these meditations, joy and another quality you could call ease, as conscious experiences fall away until finally the only quality that's left is one-pointedness, which is of course extremely tranquil and very well, very settled. So it's not so much that the joy is excluded, it's that it requires no further focus. And all there is one-pointedness in the midst of arising experience. And then supposedly you go into these other states where you encounter unlimited consciousness, and then unlimited space, and then something called nothing whatever. Nothing whatever. Oh, look, nothing whatever. How interesting. And then finally something that's called not perceiving and not perceiving, which again is a little bit enigmatic. So these are tour guides, right? Tourist manuals, and exactly how they reflect the territory is not really clear. Anyway, that's how they talk. If we acquire this sort of discover this sort of natural balance in our own body mind, a current of joy or sadness or anger or whatever it was can pass without kind of upsetting the apple cart. So there's always a quality, a certain degree of tranquility there. So there's no actual conflict. And whether or not we want to pick those threads out separately depends on circumstances.
In my experience of Buddhism, I do hear the word joy quite often.
You do?
Like sambhogakaya, the joy state, sambhogakaya.
Sambhogakaya. Yeah.
And then the four immeasurables.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And as the daily practice. And then I was thinking that, and wishing to benefit, we have the Bodhisattva vow, so mm-hmm. wishing to benefit beings.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe that this is engineering it falsely, but cultivating certain states,
mm-hmm.
even if it's all sort of contrived,
uh-huh.
and wishing that other beings have it rather than depression and joy, or
yeah.
but that's all probably contrived.
Yeah. Well, that's the antidotal orientation, which is very well established in Buddhism and can be very effective.
Okay.
But that's one of many that have developed over the centuries. If, for instance, one is troubled by gloom and melancholy, maybe meditating, doing the Brahma Viharas as you express them, that can be quite helpful. But the Brahma Viharas, the four immeasurables, loving kindness, compassion, joy, and equanimity, those can be very useful as both as antidotal meditations. And I think, you know, maybe those can even be said to be full practices leading to awakening at some point.
The Shunko says those are preliminaries.
Hmm?
Shunko says those are all preliminaries.
Preliminary? Did he say preliminary to what?
What he's
practicing. Of course. Preliminary. Well, that's another skillful means.
Yes. You know?
And if that encourages people, great. But yeah, it's true. There are, you know, these four Brahma Viharas, the four, what are they called? Illimitable sublime states, somebody translates them as. And one is loving kindness, compassion, pariti or joy, and equanimity. And of course, joy there tends to be joy directed towards the liberation of others. So it's not so much, it's not self-directed, but other-directed. And it's a little bit different from this current of joyful awareness that I'm talking about. It's not, again, no conflict, but it's a slightly different cultivation. Yes?
Isn't it sometimes not sympathetic joy?
Sympathetic, uh-huh, yeah, mm-hmm. right, sympathetic joy.
Joy for the joy of others.
Of others, quite, yeah, exactly, yeah.
I think it's very tricky. I remember being a teen and then a car, somebody was listening to like NPR, and there's some author being interviewed, and the author said, happiness is like a ghost, and you can't force it to come.
Uh-huh.
I remember how angry I was. Like, how dare you insinuate that uh-huh. you can't sort of, you know, manufacture your own happiness,
mm-hmm.
you know, that you had to, like, wait for this ghost to just show up.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, I don't know, I still feel very, I can still feel that sort of sense
you
of,
you resent like, this.
Yeah, the, yes. the sense that, you know, mm-hmm. oh, you can't make it happen.
Yeah. Well, interestingly, Robert Johnson does distinguish between happiness and joy. Happiness being a more ephemeral quality that attaches to certain circumstances, and joy being an actual kind of current of our life that needs to be honored, really. So you can, to some degree, contrive happiness only temporarily. I mean, such that you may look, a new motorcycle. Oh, I'm happy, you know, or something, right? And that'll last for a while. But this quality of joy that's actually inseparable from our being is a little different. And in the Greek myths, of course, the whole mythos around Dionysus has to do with this quality of joy that spontaneously arises and needs to be, as I say, acknowledged and cared for the way the Greeks actually had a god, you know, god of joy or ecstasy. It's a little bit different from happy. And again, it's a quality of our being rather than the result of arranging certain circumstances. Does it click at all for you? You still resent the fact that you can't be?
No, but it's just a constant temptation.
Oh, of course, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, you're young yet, and at some point you may realize, you know, this is not going anywhere. I think I'll just stop this. Yeah.
This might not be retrievable, but you began your talk a year ago,
mm-hmm.
and I'd love to hear it again.
Oh, that is retrievable. Yeah. That is our ancestor Shuto, who's a long, long ago Chinese character. And his poem, The Song of the Grass Hut, he says, if you want to know the undying one in the hermitage, don't separate from this skin bag right now, meaning this body. Which is, again, a little bit, depending on one's psychology and experience, it might be surprising. Mm-hmm. It's like, because, you know, I thought the enlightened state is somewhere up there, and it couldn't possibly have anything to do with this person right here, right now. And here's our ancestor saying, oh, yes, it does. In fact, it has everything to do with this person right now. And if you try to separate from that, you will, as they sometimes say, you will just be a ghost wandering the trees, clinging to rocks. Yeah.
Excuse me for beating a dead horse, so to speak. But sounds like there's definitely a distinction between this current of joy and the sensation or experience of joy that may or may not come up, and if it does come up, it surely will fall away.
Yeah.
And maybe that joy, that experience that comes up is more like, I'm happy because I'm having some experience of this current of joy.
You could put it that way.
Sort of pick it out.
Yeah. Well, In a manner of speaking, it is a current that arises into consciousness sometimes and then falls away. And what we're talking about is cultivating a sensitivity to that current and its arising and passing away. And it's true, as I said, we can kind of get hung up on those moments where it arises into consciousness and try to hang on to them or figure out how to make it stay around. And that, of course, would be self-defeating. But so I usually, as I say, I think of it as a current that is constantly flowing, and it at times arises into consciousness, and at times is not obviously present.
So would it be fair to say that if a person is always chasing happiness, they might drown out whatever experiences they could have of joy?
Yes. It's like, what was that old song? Chasing the bright, elusive butterfly of love. You know, it's like you're constantly running around the landscape with your net, trying to grab this thing. You're going to miss something. Right? So the pursuit of happiness, although we are supposedly guaranteed that in our culture, what exactly that means is that may be an important question. So maybe, you know, instead of life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, we should have life, liberty, and the sense of joy in our own being. Something like that. Which is guaranteed us by our own humanity. So that's a little different from chasing happiness.